Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Yama, I'm Bo Spearham and this is Let's Talk. I would like to acknowledge the country on which we are broadcasting from and also to. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders, also to our young people around the continent who is tuning in via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our website, 989fm.com.au. Today on the program, I am going to be talking about something a little bit close to home for me, where my family come from, in a town called Moree. Over the last 3 months, the community, some family members, have been continuing the search for a young 22-year-old Aboriginal man by the name of Gordon Copeland. On the 10th of July, early hours of the night, was the last time Gordon was seen. On the program today, I'm very thankful that I have some time with the CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service from New South Wales and for New South Wales and the ACT. My guest is Nadine Miles, and I'll bring her in right now. Good morning, Nadine, and thank you for joining us on the program.
Very happy to be here, Bo. Thank you very much for the introduction.
Before we go any further, could you please tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, my name is Nadine Miles, and I'm actually a Gubba, but I am someone who was born and raised in Queensland and came down to Sydney to finish my studies way back when in 1996, and joined the Aboriginal Legal Service then back in 1999, and have been pretty much with the Aboriginal Legal Service for most of that time. I'm very passionate about justice for Aboriginal people, and it's a matter that's close to my heart.
It's great to hear. I'll say this earlier in the show, and because I want this to be a question before you leave as well. And I'm going to be reading from the media release that you guys released yesterday. Gordon is one of 17 Aboriginal people who died in police or prison operations, whose coronial inquest, the Aboriginal Legal Service is acting in and representing. Also, he is one of 12 Aboriginal people who have died in police or prison operations in custody this year. And also, this year marks the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission of Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. A big year. I do want to ask those questions that will come very, very soon. But for our listeners, could you tell us a bit about what you know of Gordon and who he is?
Yes, Gordon was a young man, 22, father of one, soon to be father of two. And in the early morning of the 10th of July, police are saying that they followed a car. Gordon was in that car. The car was stopped, and police also are saying that they followed, they attempted to speak to Gordon, and he ran from the car. Police are alleging that he ran into the river. That's the police version of events. Of course, the matter is with the coroner now. Family have some different views about that, and those matters will be explored, and findings of fact will be made by the coroner in a subsequent coronial investigation, but the matter is with the coroner now. Family are very interested in understanding what happened, of course, and why it's the case that police are saying that Gordon ran from them. What is going to be of significance in this matter, the family are hoping, is the body cam that was being worn by officers at the time. But at this point in time, of course, none of those details have been released, and they are all matters that will be canvassed in the coroner's court in due course.
Mm-hmm. You did answer one of my questions, which was the last known time when Gordon was seen. You did mention that was when he was followed or in pursuit by police. My next question would be then, from the initial time he went missing, which was well over 3 months ago, and as you mentioned, the 10th of July, and then he was recently found in the river. I just want to read a statement from your media release as well. The police told media they never stopped searching for Gordon, but the family don't believe that's true. Meanwhile, the family and supporters were forced to search the river themselves. The family spent over $8,000 on wetsuits, boats, cameras and other expenses, said one of the family members in the statement. Could I get you to just to sort of address that as well?
Sure. The family have not been happy at all in relation to how police have handled this matter. The search never stopped from the Pat family's perspective. There were family members and friends and community members that were out each day trying to locate Gordon. Police were searching. Police scaled down their search. I'm sure the matters will be canvassed at the coroner's court as to what kind of resources police were putting into the search, but the police scaled down the search. The family were making efforts continually at trying to get the search broadened and extended to try and locate Gordon. They, of course, were writing letters to ministers, their local member. There were public calling. There was actually a very significant community march where over, I think, 300 people gathered and protested and were calling for the police to take the search seriously, to put everything that they could into it. So it's one of those situations, Bo, where the family is saying that not enough was done. They wanted to see more. They were agitating as best as they could. I should say ALS was supporting them through that, trying to use our influence as well to see the search increase. Unfortunately, it took engagement by the coroner of New South Wales for the police to take the matter back and to actually expand the search, and that was done quite recently. Mm-hmm. And that was when Gordon's body was found.
And if I could just jump in really quickly as well, within that as well, I was reading some articles. I think it was from The Guardian, and it mentioned the extent of the reopening of the search using police dogs, SAS or SES, obviously more officers. I think there was a helicopter as well. There was quite a bit of resources chucked in this time.
That's right. But that that expanded search and those efforts came late in the eyes of the family, and only came at the calling of the coroner, as opposed to the police hearing the cries and the calls from the family and the community themselves, who, I said, protested. I think it was on July the 28th. The family protested with community members, around 300 people. Calling for the police to expand the search and to do all they could to find Gordon at the time. It wasn't until, again, just recently, that they expanded the search and threw what they could at it.
The tragedy,
of course, being that Gordon was found very close to the location that the police are alleging that he entered the river. Very close indeed, around 500 metres from the spot that he went into the river. These are things, of course, as I said, will be explored at the coroner's court, and we will find out all that we can in relation to those matters on behalf of the family.
Definitely. And in regards to me asking questions about Gordon, it is still an earlier time, as you mentioned. The family, as well as the ALS, yourself, have some more investigations that they want to do before anything further can come from that. Hopefully, we find out more very, very soon as well. I do want to give, a shout out to the family and the community of Moree. Very, very strong people. As I mentioned earlier, I have family. My old man was born and raised in Moree as well. We do regular trips down there as well. So, I know how strong the community is, and in the last 3 months has shown their dedication and their love and the strength that this community has for one another as well, especially when times are like this, and it really matters to sort of be with community as well. I do want to shift it now as well. One of the reasons is because I can't ask any more questions in regards to what has happened or what is happening. I do want to shift it to those first two things that I mentioned earlier as well. The ALS is representing 17 families or are representing 17 people who have died in police and prison custody as well. And then also he's one of 12. Last year at the height of the pandemic, there was the Black Lives Matter protest, and at the forefront in Australia was the voices of loved ones who've lost family in custody, and the images of these individuals, these human beings who are family members who are very, very loved. We're at a point now where family continuing to, go down this road of wanting to fight for justice. I'd just love to get your comments on that. He is one of 17 who you're representing, and then one of 12 who have died this year as well.
Yeah. You also mentioned Ricky Dick, a Royal Death, Royal Commission into Deaths in Custody, which, of course, is a seminal piece of work done 30 years ago, which included over 130 recommendations as to what that Royal Commission thought could make a difference into the lives of Aboriginal people, particularly those that found themselves in custody with police corrective services. And still we see significant numbers across the country of Aboriginal people dying at the hands of police corrective service officers, whether they're in physical custody or whether they're being pursued or being whether or they're actually in the control of the police or corrective services at the time. So these things unfortunately continue to plague the Aboriginal community, not just in New South Wales or the ACT, but across the country as a whole. And we all know that every time there is a death in custody or in a critical incident with police, it really drives at the heart of the community as a whole. And the pain and the reverberation is felt across the community where that person comes from, but it also just reverberates across the country as a whole. And we are just absolutely devastated with the numbers that are coming through right now that we as a service are acting in. As you said, we've got 17 matters in our practice at the moment that have happened over the last few years. Coronial inquests do take some time to finalise, and in some instances it takes several years for the family to have answers, and sometimes unfortunately they don't get the answers or the details that they're seeking because of the processes of the coroner's court. So it's an area of justice that we as an Aboriginal legal service take extremely seriously, because we know the effects that it has, not just, as I said, to the community, but to the country as a whole. Every time there is a death in custody or at the hands of police or corrective services, it reverberates and causes significant pain for all Aboriginal people. And we recognise that and take the practice of coronial court matters very seriously. Mm. I wish it was different. I wish the advocacy that we do
the fighting that we do to raise attention and to speak on behalf of the families in this area of law would make a difference. We continue with that fight. We won't give up the struggle. And we're doing what we can right now for not just Gordon Copeland's families, but for the families of all of our clients who have lost loved ones in custodial settings or in situations where the police are involved. They are critical incidents, as I said, and we represent families in those situations as well.
Mm. I know you're very busy. I do have one more question.
Sure.
And, you know, with the history of the Aboriginal Legal Service in New South Wales and the Northern, and in the ACT, you know, over the 30 years, I will just talk just in this area, in the area that you service as well, has there ever been a police officer or a prison guard ever found guilty or, I don't know what the word is, implicated in the murder or the death of an Aboriginal person?
One of our matters, which we acted for, a matter that happened around northern New South Wales, a custodial officer was recently charged for the death, and that matter is proceeding through court. Everyone knows the story of the tall man, and unfortunately that didn't bring justice to the people of Palm Island. But there are very few instances where we have, across Australia, officers, whether they be police officers or correctional officers, being charged with murder or manslaughter. Even when they are charged, it's very unusual that convictions follow. So, this is an area of justice where we feel there is so much more justice to be served up to the community.
Mm-hmm. Nadine, thank you for coming on the program and having a chat with us. This is a very, very important matter, and the other 17 are as well. And, you know, this is something that, you know, we at the station really, really support, you know, in terms of the issues that the fight for justice, and I'd love to get yourself and the family back on in the future as well. Any details, any findings that, you know, we can broadcast and out, you know, to the broader public, we would love to get yourselves back on the program.
I'd be happy to come back, Bo. Stay in touch.
Awesome.
And I hope your listeners have a good day.
Thank you. And that was Nadine Miles, CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service in New South Wales, or for New South Wales and the ACT. Stay with us because coming up very shortly on this program, as our listeners are well aware of, we've covered this topic immensely, you know, and it's something I guess nobody would want to do. You know, I'm sure families do not want to, you know, front up to court and do this, but they do this. And as a media service, this is what we do. And stay tuned, because coming up very shortly, I'm going to play some previous interviews that I did with some Aboriginal people, answering some questions about what is a coronial inquest and what are some of the recommendations and how they are implemented or how they aren't implemented as well. Stay tuned here on Let's Talk on Murray Country 98.9 FM. And if you're tuning into the program, my guest, Nadine Miles, CEO of the Aboriginal Legal Service for New South Wales and the ACT, we were chatting about the life and the death of young Gordon Copeland, the 22-year-old Gomeroi man from Moree, who was a son, a grandson, a father, and a brother, and a community member. You know, we here at the station, we do hope for justice, and that's why we continue to give platform and a place and a home to the many families, not just here in Queensland or New South Wales, but all over the country as well. And as I said at the end of my chat with Nadine, I want to play some audio from previous Let's Talk programs. You know, I talked to two Aboriginal people. In this audio, you'll hear me speaking to two different Aboriginal people on two different occasions. And we're talking about what are the recommendations into the Aboriginal deaths in custody, and what constitutes a death in custody. I chat with Alison Whittaker, who is a Gomeroi woman, a poet and an academic, and Martin Hodgson, who is a Yuin man and an amazing lawyer. You can catch both those interviews in their entirety on our website as well. So stay tuned, because you're listening to Let's Talk.
Yeah, so the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody was started with this process called a letters patent, in which the then Prime Minister, I want to say Bob Hawke, called for effectively a Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and kind of laid out the terms of reference by which that Royal Commission could happen. And so the Royal Commission initially wanted to review about, I think it was 122 deaths that had happened to mob in custody over the period, the decade immediately preceding. So that was 1980 to 1989, I believe. And actually what happened was through a bit of litigation and pressure on behalf of state government, that pool of cases, the deaths that they reinvestigated, was reduced to about 99. But the reason that the Royal Commission itself was called for was not because of any inherent generosity from Prime Minister Bob Hawke or from anybody in his ministry. It was actually because there had been very, very strategic, concerted organising campaigns on behalf of families who'd lost loved ones in custody. I'm thinking especially of the families of John Patt, who was a young boy who was killed by off-duty police officers in Western Australia, and also of the family of Eddie Murray, who was killed in Weewall in New South Wales. So their organising and the amount of public sustained pressure that they were able to keep up in relation to the deaths of their loved ones, deaths that occurred in highly violent circumstances and in which there was absolutely no evidence of accountability. Actually, what seemed to happen was that there was this large-scale complicity in the investigations of their deaths that meant they were either portrayed as suicides or natural causes. And that wasn't unique to young Eddie Murray or young John Patt. It was endemic to most of the deaths in custody that occurred in that 10-year period. And so their pressure, the appearance of, which actually I think was mass kind of state complicity and to some degree cover-up, really drove the mandate home that this exercise of state power was effectively the continuation of colonial power that just carried from the frontier wars into instead the use of police force. And there's a fantastic book that covers some of this journey that I encourage everybody to read called Eddie's Country, kind of covering what happened in the wake of Eddie's death and the massive strategic organising work of his family that made the conversation, even that we're having now, about Black deaths in custody possible. So the combination of their advocacy and broader advocacy on deaths in custody that put enough pressure on that the Royal Commission was established. And it took about 3 years to go through its evidence. In doing so, it kind of talked to a lot of communities about general, quote-unquote, problems with policing and imprisonment of our mob. But they also did original reinvestigations of the 99 deaths that they were looking at as well. So those are kind of the two main things that it did, was reinvestigate those deaths and talk to the community about actually what was happening on the ground. And it came up with 339 recommendations, which we're still grappling with to this day.
And like I said, I don't want to say one's as violent as the other, but, how wide is sort of the scope of what is constituted as sort of a death in custody?
Yeah, you've effectively covered it. So in the Royal Commission, it was cast quite broadly as effectively kind of any death in which police or prisons or a form of incarceration was involved. Even if its role, as you said, was kind of actually about giving the death an unnatural context in which to happen, it's, again, as you said, in each context, these deaths are violent. But the ones that people really organised around in going into the Royal Commission were deaths where people had died, and I'm going to use some details now, so tune out if you need to. But where people had died from blunt force injuries to their head, or where, you know, someone had alleged that they'd fallen, or where people had died from compression of their neck, which is sometimes done through hanging, but which families said actually, like, there's no way that these wounds could have been self-inflicted. So that's kind of the political pressure that was exerted in the lead-up to the Royal Commission. But as you said, deaths in custody cover such a wide range of subtle colonial violence to really overt colonial violence.
What are some of those recommendations as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, of those 339 recommendations, some of the easiest ones were implemented straight away. But the ones that really count, whether they be things about the prison system itself and the removal of hanging points, we have to understand is, I think, that far too many people look at the Royal Commission's recommendations as being the total solution. It's not. It is 30 years old, and we do know a lot more now. But if you look at the removal of hanging points, still hasn't been addressed. So far too many cells have points inside that cell where a person can suicide from. But what's never discussed is the fact that guards so often supply the sheets for the person to commit suicide and torment the person until they do. And it's a very common phenomenon. So as far as I'm concerned, those guards should be charged with murder. That would be a serious implementation of that recommendation. One of the other recommendations is that all deaths in custody be treated as a homicide first and foremost, and for suicide or it being a medical issue, not to just be presumed from the start. Because one thing we know very early on in, whether it's a murder trial or any death, that if you make presumptions, you don't collect all the evidence.
So can I just ask about that one? So as soon as somebody is sort of presented as a death in custody, it's supposed to be treated as a homicide, is that right, you're saying?
Yeah, that was the recommendation.
Oh, that's the recommendation, yeah. But then, you know, like, and this is just from chatting to a few people, which will sort of be my next question. So after somebody passed away, I guess, in suspicious terms, you know, there's the coronial inquest, which determines the manner of how somebody passes away. How within the recommendations then is that sort of considered, you know, like, where does the homicide sort of sit in that? Because sometimes, you know, they more so talk about the way that they died, I guess, not necessarily it being, you know, they died due to sort of, you know, being roughed up or, you know, having a knee to the neck or, you know, like physical pressure being put on them. So this is just, you know, my understanding, which is very little within this space as well, like, yeah, how do those two things, you know, is there a contradiction with that, or how does that work with the coronial inquest?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. And one of the problems is that once a death ends up in the coroner's court, it's highly unlikely that the police or corrective services will ever be charged. A coroner can refer the matter to the DPP, but largely the coronial inquest is about how the person died, the sort of medical situation. And it's another area we have to question, because part of the recommendations were that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should have their own representation, but more importantly probably is that we should be able to have our own pathologist present at the first autopsy. Because if that original pathologist who works for the coroner makes a mistake, then you will never be able to reverse those results. And we know this is a problem because in South Australia, until very recently, for more than three decades, the head forensic pathologist in South Australia had no qualifications whatsoever and was found to have made endless erroneous rulings as to how people had died, both for coronial inquests and in murder cases. He's long since been struck off. Many of the people who were convicted as a result of his work have been freed. One of them who hasn't is an innocent Aboriginal man named Derek Bromley, who's been in prison for nearly 40 years for a crime he didn't commit. And again, this goes to the forensic work and just the medical side of things. So we really need very early on when someone does die that it be treated as a potential homicide, that we are able as a community to have our own lawyers present throughout that process, and that we can engage our own independent forensic experts to ensure that the initial autopsies and all that medical work is done properly. Because what people also have to understand is this is all done by the same people who work with the police every day. Throughout this entire system, you know, whether it's justice, health and corrective services or the police and forensic pathology, they all work together. And so we shouldn't be surprised when they find reasons to help their friends or work colleagues get away with the crimes they've committed. It's not some grand conspiracy. It's simply the facts that people need to begin to look at a lot more clearly. And if the authorities aren't worried that that would be exposed, then they should follow those recommendations that we have lawyers present throughout the process and that we can engage our own forensic experts to question this, which you can do in a murder trial and currently you cannot do in a death in custody. Why not? A murder trial supposedly is seeking to get to the truth, and an investigation into a death in custody is supposed to be doing the same. So if that's the case, then we should be allowed our own forensic experts.
This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And that was audio from Alice Whittaker, a previous interview that we did here on Let's Talk this year, and also Martin Hodgson, both two amazing Aboriginal people who continue to fight for justice for our mob, especially those who have lost loved ones in custody or those, in custody as well, trying to be free with the injustice as we heard in this program. Very, very quickly as well, why I wanted to play that is the whole process can be very confusing to people. It is to me, it still is. I'm not saying I'm an expert. I'm not saying I've been through what our families have been through. And I hope, I never go through that. But I want to learn it. I want to learn and understand it more, so that's why I wanted to play it. And I hope the listeners, you guys, learn a bit from this as well. It is something that continues to happen. Sadly, last Thursday, an Aboriginal man was shot and killed in Toowoomba, and an Aboriginal woman was found, in South Australia, and recently Gordon Copeland's body has been found. In a river 500 metres from where he entered 3 months ago as well. These things continue to happen to Aboriginal people. This is why we need to know this process and understand it, so when justice doesn't happen, we can identify it and we can say, hey, wait a minute, you know, what's wrong with the system. If you've enjoyed this program, you can catch the repeat at 7 p.m. tonight. You can also head to our website at 989fm.com.au and follow the links to the podcast. This will be up a little bit later on in the day. And you've been listening to Let's Talk here on 989FM, Murray Country. And as always, it's a pleasure.